Vaishnav Vedanta sources. So people and devotees also in our very troubled times are much interested in the mind, how it works, why we have problems with our mind. Unfortunately, the subject of psychology, as it is known and practiced in the West, is very subjective. Subjective means that it is very much opinionated, very much according to what people, different people, think with their different minds, coming to different conclusions. And so if any of you, and probably some of you have, looked at books on psychology, what you notice is that there are many different conceptions of what the mind is, how it works, and what we need for our mental health. And this, of course, becomes quite perplexing, especially if one is serious about finding answers to the problems of the mind. So we should know, especially those of you who are here, who are obviously interested in Krishna consciousness, practicing Krishna consciousness to some degree, chanting Hare Krishna, reading Srila Prabhupada's books. You should know that in Srila Prabhupada's books, particularly Srimad Bhagavatam, that there is a very detailed explanation of what the mind is, how it works, the problems, mental problems that we get, and also how to cure these problems. I've noticed that devotees often, they miss this. They read the Bhagavatam, but they don't understand how the Bhagavatam is teaching us so much about our mind, its structure, its functions, and its problems. And so we see that devotees are, when they're faced with such problems of the mind, that often they're going to other sources, they're going into Western psychology and so forth to seek help. It apparently means that they think that somehow Srimad Bhagavatam has skipped over this subject, or Prabhupada's books has skipped over it. So the reason I give this seminar is to show you that it is not true that this subject matter is neglected. In fact, here you get objective information about the mind, not just what this or that psychologist supposes, thinks, but actually you get very scientific and objective. Objective means as it actually is, apart from our human opinions. A very objective look at what the mind is. So today's talk will be introductory. Each day I am going to be going more into the Shastric details. But today I just want to kind of set the stage, set up the basic issues that we'll be investigating in this seminar. So the first point, there's a saying from Bengal that one may travel in this world seeking to flee the old problems and start a new life by establishing oneself in a new situation. But this Bengali proverb says, wherever you go seeking this new life, you have to take your mind with you. So in this way, we really don't escape our problems simply by changing our place and changing the people around us. And we need to understand that this mind that we take with us wherever we go, this is actually the principal source of all our difficulties in this world. It is not even the gross physical body that is the source of our problems. It's the mind. Because we perceive this body that we have, this physical body, through our mind also. And so if the mind is very much disturbed by attachment, you see, obsessed with attachment, then the way we view this body will set us up for miseries. Because of course the gross physical body, it passes away in time, gradually, hopefully gradually and not suddenly. But when the mind is harboring much attachment, then we become of course very attached to this body, especially in the young years when the body is strong and beautiful, attractive to others. We become very attached to it. And then as time goes on and the body deteriorates, old age, disease, and death coming closer, then that attachment becomes lamentable, you see. We think back when we were youthful and had so much fun in this body, and now those people we know, or we used to know, they're no longer around, or they're not friendly to us anymore. People see us as old now, they're not interested in us, we feel neglected. So this is actually coming from the mind, not the physical body. One can see in India, I was also in Nepal in May, in the mountains, seeing how the people live in the village in their stone houses in the mountains. So people whose minds are relatively simple and free of attachment, then you see they're very youthful, they're very vigorous, positive, optimistic, even when physically they seem to be very old. I saw in Nepal how even apparently old people, they're so much physically stronger than we are here, living up thousands of meters up in the mountain air. They're able to do so much more work, and it's not just physical, it's that their mentality is much more optimistic, much more free of the obsessions of attachment. So really, it's our mind that is, if we're suffering in this world, it's because of the mind. We need to know that. We need to stop pointing the finger, you know, here and there, outside of ourselves. It's because of this person that I suffer, or because I'm in this place, or this combination of circumstances. If that could be changed. No, but as this Bengali phrase says, wherever you go, you have to take your mind with you. So if the mind is prone to lament, to be too attached, to be miserable, then wherever you go, our miseries will follow us. So the Bhagavad Gita warns us that the untamed mind, the mind that is not under proper control, is the worst enemy of the human being. So therefore, if our our mind is our enemy, and for most people, even after practicing Krishna consciousness for a long time, we cannot assume. We can see this quite plainly in the history of our movement. A devotee cannot assume, even after 20, 30 years of practicing Krishna consciousness, oh, now my mind is my friend, and I can relax with my mind and let my mind wander here and there. You see? So we have to be very, very careful about this mind, not trusting it. And if we have to struggle or fight with the mind because he's acting as our enemy, then you know, you have to know your enemy before you face an enemy. You have to know what his strategy is, what his strengths are, how he will try to attack. And that's what we are trying to accomplish in this seminar. So the very good news is that the mind is not us. And this is a big, big lesson we have to understand. Because most people in this world, they're under this conception. When they say I, they're referring to the mind. But I am the spirit soul. And the mind is not the same as the spirit soul. Now, on the other side, that does not mean that I can then dismiss the mind. Oh, as something unreal. This used to be a policy some years ago. One would hear this a lot in ISKCON, this type of preaching. That the mind is just nonsense, just maya, and you just ignore it. No, that is also not a good program. The mind is a very real thing. It is listed in Bhagavad Gita among the eight elements of creation. It is subtle, of course, but it has substance. It is substance. Let's hear something from Srila Prabhupada. Purport in the Srimad Bhagavatam 3rd canto. He writes that since the mind is a product of the mode of goodness, if it is fixed upon the Lord of the mind, Aniruddha, then the mind can be changed to Krishna consciousness. It is stated by Narottam Das Thakur that we always have desires. Desire cannot be stopped. But if we transfer our desires to please Supreme Personality of Godhead, that is the perfection of life. As soon as the desire is transferred to lording it over material nature, it becomes contaminated by matter. And in another purport, Prabhupada writes, the essential point is that the mind, which is contaminated by material attraction, has to be bridled and concentrated on the Supreme Personality of Godhead. So you see, as devotees, we have to work with the mind. You cannot just ignore it, just dismiss it. Oh, it's maya. It's not me. Forget about it. It's very clear from what Prabhupada writes here that we must engage the mind. And Prabhupada has indicated here that the mind is the reservoir of our desires. So I, from these purports, two purports we just heard, I've extracted five basic points. So I want to list these points. Number one is that the essential substance of the mind is the mode of goodness, the sattva guna, which is the energy of Lord Aniruddha. So Aniruddha is actually the localized supersoul feature of the Supreme Personality of Godhead, the Lord in our own heart. So our mind is an energy that the Paramatma, supersoul, has bequeathed to us. He has given us this energy for our use in this material existence. So the second point is that when that sattvic mental substance is dedicated to the Lord, it is transformed to Krishna consciousness, which is the state of infallible goodness above the three modes of material nature. Third point, To dedicate the mind to the Lord, we must channel the flow of our desires toward His lotus feet. So therefore, there can be no question of controlling the mind or fixing the mind or pacifying the mind without the reformation of desire. This is very, very important. Any consideration, these stock phrases, to conquer the mind, any program like that, unless it is aimed at reforming desire, it will surely fail. So, our mind is subject to the quality of our desire. The fourth point is that from the logic of a previous point, number two, it is clear that the original condition of mind is Krishna consciousness. That original condition is contaminated as soon as our desire flows towards the lording it over of matter. So this is also interesting. That originally mind is simply consciousness. Consciousness is the energy, the light of the soul. So the original state of mind is that. It is consciousness and therefore it is spiritual. It is our very awareness. But when our desire flows towards controlling and enjoying matter, then our consciousness comes under the modes of material nature. And that contaminated consciousness then becomes a material thing. This is also explained in Bhagavatam. Then that consciousness, Chaitanya, is counted as part of the material creation. Because it's no longer, it's our consciousness, but it's no longer acting spiritually. It's acting materially. It is involving us more and more in karma. So that's important to understand. Then the fifth point is that in essence, if you want an essential definition of the material mind, like a sutra definition, the material mind is the condition of material attraction. That's what the material mind is. It's the condition of our attraction to material nature. So again, the mind is a real thing because it is the energy of the supersoul. So on the energetic level of our mental activities, thinking, imagination, visualization, concentration, these are real movements. You see, yes, they're happening somewhere, we say, somewhere up here. And they don't feel like physical movements, physical exertion, but they are real energetic movements. And they unfold as per a very, very complex pattern. Everybody's mind is different. Of course, basically everyone's mind is the same, but when we come down to individuality, then everyone's mind is ultimately different. And so our psychologies, this is another reason why psychology is such a difficult subject matter, because when you start to come down to each person, it's a different psychology, you see. We can talk about generalities so far, but when we come to a specific person, then the psychology also becomes specific. And why is this? See, anyone's mind is generally very, especially in this Western world, speaking of those of us who were born and grown up in the West, so Western world is the place of complicated mentality. Very complicated. And then you have a collection like the city of Stockholm, 1.5 million people or whatever it is, complicated mentalities interacting. It becomes very, 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 very complicated. So why is it so complicated? Why is the mind so mysterious? Why is it suddenly dragging us in very unexpected ways? and so convoluted, you know, it's so, it turns on itself like a bowl of spaghetti. Our thoughts are all entangled, and it's very difficult to trace them. You trace one and you come to several other thoughts, and you follow them and you come to more, and it just becomes so, so complicated. So why is that? Because it's complicated, because the mind moves according to our desires. Or in other words, according to our material attraction. So it's desire that makes all this so complicated. And as I said, the Western world is the place where you find the most complicated mentality. And the Western world, Western civilization, is this civilization which is focused on desire. I mean, the whole idea of this civilization is that if you have desires, then satisfy them. And this, all this, you see this city here, these big buildings, the cars racing back and forth, the flashing lights, the signs attracting you to this or that activity. This is all simply there as an attempt to satisfy desire. Well, first of all, to provoke desire. You see, to provoke, first of all, to implant in our minds that there's so many possibilities of sense gratification. And then, here's an opportunity. You can satisfy that desire. So that's what this Western civilization is all about. And therefore, yes, the mentality is so complicated. And the mind is so powerful that it has physical effects. In other words, it's obvious. The state of our body, even health, the way our body looks, the face, the way we move, all these things have so much influence by the mind. So this is also showing us that the mind is a very real thing, because it has power over matter. So Bhagavad Gita speaks of the field of activities, and as we will learn in these enumerations of the field of activities, whether it's some places it's described to have 23 aspects or 24 aspects or 16 aspects, or there's other different enumerations, but of these enumerations, the most important is the mind. So, actually, when we speak of controlling the mind, then, as per the logic of what I've said already, that must mean, that has to mean, somehow gaining control over desire. But the thing we have to understand, that this is impossible. This opens up a whole other chapter of our attempts to control our mind, our futile attempts again and again. Because, and this is coming from not understanding the mind, and not understanding what is moving the mind, desire. We arm ourselves to battle with our mind. And again we fail in that fight. So this head-on attack, now, finally, I've had enough. Now I'm going to defeat the mind, you rascal. You see, this, head-on attack is not going to work. This we need to understand. This is hopeless. And the thing is, if we keep trying like this, then we risk ourselves becoming hopeless. Losing all hope and thinking, there's nothing I can do. My mind is too strong. I just have to surrender to it. Sorry. Sorry, devotees. I'm very sorry. It was nice trying to be Krishna conscious all these years, but it's just too much. But we have to understand that this is a very, this is the wrong strategy. wrong strategy. So we'll be explaining what the right strategy is, but as I say, this is an introduction, so I just want to point out that this is the wrong, very wrong strategy. Because we cannot, to gain control of the mind means you have to gain control over your desires, and for reasons that will become clear in later lectures, that's impossible. It's impossible. It's impossible because we don't even know what our desires are. That's Prabhupada writes that we learn from Prabhupada's writings that desires are actually more subtle than the mind. To illustrate this fact, here's a quotation from a 1974 Srimad Bhagavatam lecture. So Prabhupada states, just like in the water, in a pond sometimes, you will find all of a sudden one bubble comes from within. Pat, Prabhupada, he made this sound. Pat. That means the dirty things are within, stalked. So what this example means is that the surface of the pond, imagine looking at a small pond or a lake, not a big lake. So the surface of the pond is our surface awareness, our mental awareness, the mind that we know. The bubble that rises from the bottom of the pond is a desire. Suddenly, pat, in that, you see, you can imagine this nice surface of the pond, mirror-like surface, very smooth. And suddenly, pat, there is a filthy desire breaking into our nice, peaceful thoughts. And we ask ourselves, why? Why am I getting troubled by this nonsense? Which I thought, after so many years of chanting Hare Krishna, I had gotten rid of. Why is it suddenly there again? So what this is showing us is that below the surface of the mind there is a realm that we're unable to see into. And Prabhupada said at the bottom somewhere there's, because when bubbles come up it means there's some fermentation, something is rotting at the bottom of the pond, some vegetation or something has sunk down there and is fermenting and creates gas, and that's why the bubbles come up. So similarly, something deep within us is rotten. And we can't see what it is. You see? And it's sending up these desires into our surface mind. So when I was talking about this policy of fighting desires, we only know the surface mind. So all of our resolutions to be determined, to take control, to suppress these desires, this is all in the surface mind. We don't know. We can't even see what's going on underneath. So this is why fighting, declaring war on your own desire is impossible. You don't even know what's there. So this under the surface realm, below the surface, this is what Prabhupada, he used this term, subconscious. And in days to come, we will explain that using Sanskrit terminology, telling you exactly what the subconscious is. But for right now, we only need to consider this, that there's a subconscious, and down there, this mind is reproducing any type of sensual impression that we have ever experienced, because it is a storehouse, and not just from this lifetime, from all of our lifetimes that we've ever had, all any birth that we've ever had in any species, impressions are stored away. Prabhupada compared it to a photographic spool. So anything we've experienced is stored there. Prabhupada gives the example of when you dream at night, because dreaming is when the subconscious becomes more powerful. The subconscious comes up to the, or actually not that the subconscious comes up to the surface, but we go down in our dreams into the subconscious realm more. And as Prabhupada explained, you may dream of a golden mountain. So what the mind does, we may not have ever seen an actual golden mountain, but we have seen gold and we've seen mountain. and the mind combines them. So this is a very, very prominent function of the mind, combining imagery, drawing things from past experience and combining them together. This is creativity. This artists are doing, writers are doing, you see, bringing up these images and combining them in interesting ways. So the mind is like a television into the storehouse of subconscious desires. By the power of this mind, you can hear, taste, smell, and feel things that are not directly present before the senses. You see, in sadhana bhakti, we try to control our sensory impressions. We like to be in the temple where we can see the deity and see other devotees. We like to regulate our activities so that our senses are not coming in contact with objects that will stimulate lust or something like that. But the thing is, the mind itself has a bank of all kinds of sensations. And again, not from this life only. From every life that we've ever lived in any species. So even without any external stimulation, the mind can generate all kinds of forbidden images itself. And you can experience these things on the subtle plane. It's not just that you see them, but you can hear them, you can feel them, you can taste them, you can touch them in the mind. So there's a verse from the 7th canto of Srimad Bhagavatam. This is spoken by Sri Prahlad Maharaj. And the translation is, O Lord, O Supreme Eternal, by expanding your plenary portion, in other words, the Vishnu Tattva Paramatma expansions, you have created the subtle bodies of the living entities through the agency of your external energy, which is agitated by time. Thus the mind entraps the living entities in unlimited varieties of desires to be fulfilled by the Vedic directions of karma kanda, fruitive activity, and the 16 elements. Who can get free of this entanglement unless he takes shelter at your lotus feet? So Prabhupada, in his word-for-word translation, he marked the word manaha in this verse, which means mind, with an asterisk. And when you look down at the bottom of the page, we find this footnote. The mind is always planning how to remain in the material world and struggle for existence. It is the chief part of the subtle body, which consists of mind, intelligence, and false ego. So this is interesting. We have in the subtle body also intelligence and also false ego, but the mind is the chief part. And why is it the chief part? Because that is where the desires are. And in this material world, our desires and our false ego, our intelligence and our false ego are simply serving the desires. So that is why the mind, which is a storehouse of desires, is the chief part of the subtle body. And that's why so many times you find in Prabhupada's books when he'll refer to the subtle body as just the mind. He'll translate subtle body as mind. So that's very often you'll find this word mind is also including intelligence and false ego. So we have so many, many, many desires bubbling down in the subconscious. Of course, some of them we know, most obvious desires are there in our life, but there are many, many more which only get their chance in dreams to really manifest, or even they don't come out in dreams so much. But they're there, and they're affecting us. And our mind is creating associations because of these desires. People ask, when I give this seminar, one of the questions that has come a few times is this phenomenon known as déjà vu in French, that you find yourself in a place where you really are sure you've been before. It seems so familiar, but actually, physically, you were never there, at least in this lifetime. And so people want to know, what does that mean? Does it mean that I was in this place in a previous life, maybe. Well, maybe that's what it means. But what you can be sure of is that the mind is associating this. There are things down in the subconscious. So many things, so many impressions, so many desires and impressions stored up. And the mind is very, very quick to associate them with experiences that we're having now. And so we get this sense of familiarity. We may not have been in that place ever, but there's just something down there in the storehouse that the mind associates, and then it feels familiar to us. Or suddenly there's strong desire, we meet some person and this generates some strong desire in ourselves, lust or hatred or something else. And why is this going on? Yes, because all of these things deep down bubbling away. So it is generally not practical, would not be advisable to try to identify all of these desires that are down in the subconscious. There are actually some movements or mental health processes which do this, or try to do this. In fact, before I became a devotee, I kind of messed around with one such group for about a week or two before I became disgusted. But they had a thing where you grab some, you put your hands on some handles which are actually electrically sensitive. They can detect the changes of stimuli in the skin. And there's a needle, there's an instrument with a needle, and then the person asks you questions, and then this instrument is registering your reaction to the questions, and he's trying to take you back into not only experiences in this life but previous lifetimes and relive these things. And then when the needle is jerking in a certain way, there you have, you know, some, they called them engrams. They had this weird name for some kind of mental block inside. And then the idea was you have to relive all these things and you remove these mental hang-ups. So in this way, by this process, they attempt to reveal all of the subconscious, all what's going down there. But this is, as we will learn, this is actually impossible to do. One can see the entire mind and all the desires, but only at a very advanced state of Krishna consciousness, when one actually comes to a Vasudeva Sattva platform. So before that time, we are under the modes of nature, Rajogun, Tamogun, as well as Sattvagun, and that is confusing us, that is blocking our vision. So rather than trying to, as devotees, uncover the subconscious and understand everything that's down there, the best thing is to understand that we have one basic desire by which we have come to this material world. That is pointed out in the Bhagavatam with the term, in the 11th canto, with the term Vipariyo Smriti. Smriti means intelligence, and Vipariyo means reversed. So our original intelligence or original consciousness is to be servant of Krishna, but it has become reversed. And that is the beginning of what we know as material consciousness, material mentality. I don't want to serve Krishna, but I want to be Krishna. So if Krishna is the Lord, I want to be Lord. If Krishna is Purusha, enjoyer, I want to enjoy. If Krishna is the center, I want to be the center. You see? So it's actually a subtle transformation. Because as Prabhupada said, we are each one of us part and parcel of Krishna. Prabhupada said each one of us is a small sample of Krishna. So these, it's very, very subtle. These propensities are there in us. These same propensities, because we are part and parcel of Krishna. But we cannot let these, if we let these propensities run wild, in other words, if they're not engaged in Krishna's service, then this tendency becomes diseased. We give up service to Krishna and we want to be Krishna. And so that desire is at the bottom of all of our other desires. And so as devotees we can recognize that. That we can understand. And our great acharyas, Narottam Das Thakur, Bhaktivinod Thakur, they have written, for example, just to name two songs, Hari Hari Bipale and Gopinath, and you see their expression of this base material desire. Bhaktivinod Thakur is even saying, I'm a demon. And I simply want sense gratification. I do not want to serve you. But in this mood, confessing that I have this horrible tendency to turn away from you, to give up my service to you, to try to be you, in spite of the fact that this is there, still, my dear Lord, please accept me. I'm struggling to take up your devotional service again. So we can simply follow in the footsteps of such great acharyas. And this is already a practical tip. Actually, these songs by the Vaishnava acharyas in our ISKCON songbook, and now there's also another nice songbook called More Songs by Vaishnava acharyas, prepared by one of my godbrothers, a very nice book. And there are other collections of Bhaktivinoda Thakur's songs, for example. And this Prema Bhakti Chandrika by Narottam Das Thakur has been translated. So all these sources are there. These Vaishnava songs are, that's real therapy for the mind. If you can simply read them, but better to learn at least how to play kartals and sing, come together with other devotees, have these bhajans singing these nice songs. This is really healing, because it is going, these songs are going right down to that basic anti-Krishna conscious desire and reforming. So this is a very practical and a very powerful tip. This is real psychotherapy. These bhajans, these Vaishnava songs. So there are two things, of course, that we have to do, positive and negative, in dealing with the mind. Negative means the mind, as Prabhupada, we heard it, quote, bridling the mind. It means like bridling a horse, you see? To bridle a horse means you put the bit in the horse's mouth, you see? And then he's got these reins going back, and you put a saddle on his back. And this way you can ride the horse, you can take control of the horse. So this is a kind of negative in the sense of restrictive. The mind has to come under restriction. And no one can complain about this. This is very silly argument. You know, sometimes you get these visitors who, especially in their dress and their hairstyle, they're exhibiting that they're very rebellious. And when the question time comes after the class, then they, why are you trying to control the mind? Why not just let it be free and be natural? You know, be completely natural. That's what they try to argue. This used to be, it's probably less now, but way back in the 60s and 70s, this was You're always meeting people like this, coming out of that hippie movement. Why not just be free, think and do whatever you like? But nobody does. Everybody, every human being is obligated to control the mind. I mean, to live in this world, you have to have money. And for that money, you have to somehow or other work. So right there, that's a regulative principle you have to observe. And then when you're working, like in these office buildings, you see people sitting at their desks. They're sitting there at their desks, and they're looking across sometimes. There's a young man in the office, he looks across, there's a nice girl sitting in the same, across the way. Or she's looking at him sometimes. And you know, whatever they're thinking. They can think so many things in the mind. You know, but you don't act on those. On such impressions may come into the mind, what you could do, but nobody acts on them. And if human society did act on them, then there would be no human society. You say, okay, if you empty out the office building and bring in a bunch of dogs, then they're going to do whatever they want to do. On the desk, you know, under the chair. They're just going to go right in, because they have no restraint at all. They're animals. But then animals, you know, they don't have a society, so to speak, as we have. So if you're a human being and you live in human society, that means there is so much already mental control. Controlling the mind, controlling the desires. But the question is, for what object? People control their minds, control their desires for sense gratification. That's what they do. Okay, we can't do this now, but later when we get home tonight, then we can. That's how it goes.